Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
This piece has been brought to you by Bonnie Plants, bonnieplants.com.
I'm Laura Stanley, host of Inside School Food. You are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Short and hot with Chef Family.
Short and hot with Chef Family.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Sharp and Hot. I am your host, Chef Emily Peterson, broadcasting to you live from Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This is episode number 125. If you missed me, missed us, missed me and Dave, it's because, and Malcolm, hey, Malcolm, Malcolm's there waving in the booth like, hey, I'm here too. It's because we took a little hiatus. I got myself back together. I'm excited. This is the official start of the spring season. Everybody had some time to relax. Dave, did you have fun on your break?
I had a great time, yeah.
Were you here the whole time?
I came to work every day as usual. Yep.
And I had two Tuesdays off, and I got my chicken coop ready. My baby chicks are coming through the mail as we speak. They will be delivered to the post office any minute. And my asparagus is coming up, so it really does feel like a spring start. So thank you all. I think I have to apologize for neglecting to tell you that I was not going to be making a podcast for 2 weeks. So if you were wondering where it was in your iTunes, I knew that was going to happen. And I think we went off the air 3 weeks ago, and I was like, oh, I forgot to mention that. But here we are. We are back, episode 125. I have a guest joining me today from the World Resources Institute, and I am super excited to introduce her. Janet, I am concerned that I'm going to butcher your last name, so I'm going to let you say it. Welcome to Sharp and Hot. Can you say your name for me?
Ranganathan, Janet Ranganathan.
Oh, I was going to be right, and then I was like, I don't know. She might say, wow, that was an interesting place to put those accents, and then I was right. Thank you so much. Now, are you based in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
This is the World Institute's global office.
I'm very excited to talk to you because this is a topic that is near and dear to my heart. You are the Vice President for Science and Research at the World Resources Institute, and your newest publication is called Shifting Diets for a Sustainable Food Future. I have just tweeted out the link if listeners want to go and take a look at the PDF. First of all, I want to say, Janet, you have, as a team, managed to make this incredibly readable and accessible to people who are maybe not government officials or policy analysts. It really, really reads like a piece of storytelling. And so thank you, first and foremost, for that.
You must have avoided the footnotes.
Oh. Anywhere the type went to 6 point, I did stop. I was like, okay, she could tell me about that on air. Well, it's in there if you're looking for it. So it can be very dense or it can be very readable. So why don't you give me a little bit of background on this paper? And I understand that it's a three-part series, and this is the third the third piece. But tell me about some of the goals that you are trying to accomplish.
So, thank you for that introduction. So Shifting Diets for a Sustainable Food Future is actually the 11th installment in a series of articles that address the issue of how do we close a 70% calorie gap between now and the food we'll need to feed the population in 2050. And that's sort of a Herculean task, just closing that gap by 70%. 70% might not feel like a lot because talk about double growth and all of that, but to actually just close that gap by increasing yields alone, yields would have to grow a third faster than they did during the period of the Green Revolution. And given that we've got constraints on agriculture now, water, the availability of water, a greenhouse gas emissions budget, the fact that we can't continue expanding into natural ecosystems, and that we've got a lot of very poor people that live at the end of our food supply chains. It's a big task. And so we looked at that as a sort of, what's a menu of solutions to tackle that? And we looked at both supply side, production, how to increase production, as well as consumption. And the shifting diets is one of the consumption solutions that we proposed.
So what are, so let me ask you, when you say a 70% calorie gap, what is that? That means that, are there not enough calories to feed everyone, or is it that the calorie allotment per person around the globe needs to be shifted?
So it's a great question, Emily. I often get asked that. So it means that in 2050, we will not, if we continue just producing the same amount as we do today, we will not have enough food to feed the population, irrespective of how we distribute it. So just not enough. So if you divide the number of people by the number of calories, we fall significantly short. So it's not just a distribution issue.
So let's talk about calories a little bit, because one of the things that I think comes as a big surprise, it's kind of like a surprise and not a surprise, right? Because we have obesity as a major, major epidemic, particularly in this country and also in other developing countries, who suddenly have access to money, and that gets translated into access to things like beef, which we can talk about. But also how much protein people are eating is like through the roof compared to what you need to eat. So how does something like this look at what people are currently consuming?
Yep. So we looked at three specific shifts that we saw happening around the globe. So overconsumption, the convergence, the trend towards overconsuming calories was one of those trends that is actually playing out across the globe. The second one was the consumption of protein. So again, a tendency towards overconsumption of protein. By overconsumption of protein, I mean, consuming more protein than you need to meet your dietary recommendations. And related to that, that there's an increasing share of animal-based protein in diets. And then the third shift we looked at was the consumption of beef, beef specifically because of its very large environmental footprint.
And one of the things that maybe you can explain that I find fascinating and also easy for people to understand is how many resources have to go into raising a cow for beef, and then the equivalent number of pounds of food or protein that come out of that cow.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that a little, that relationship?
Yeah, if you look at the edible calories, if you look at the calories that go into a cow, and you look at the human edible calories that come out, they're about 1% efficient in terms of converting input energy into human edible energy. So not a very efficient system. Compare that with chicken, poultry, which is about 11% efficient.
So, do you happen to know off the top of...
You need a lot of water, a lot of land, and you produce a lot of greenhouse gas emissions for every unit of beef that you consume.
Do you know,
to other sources,
off the top of your head, do you know what the percentage of that is for rabbits?
I don't. I've never been asked that one. I'd have to sort of look that one up. We in the report, we kind of focused more on the commonly eaten at the global level foods. It was a global report, so I don't think there's sort of a global rabbit movement, at least yet, anyway. In Australia.
I was just wondering. I have to bookmark that and come back to it, because I think, I can only imagine it's got to be really high. And one of the things you talk about in the paper is sort of creating new habits, because people eat out of habit so much. And that, like you said, the changing the amount of production is kind of, that's not going to change all that much. And people's habits are going to change very, very slowly. So what are some of those habits that you can identify that people, how did we find ourselves here?
Well, I think, some of the, first of all, we actually modeled a number of different scenarios saying, what if the U.S., average person consumed this different kind of diet? And then we looked at the sort of global impacts of the same scenarios. But what we found was that the average U.S. person, if they actually cut their meat consumption, which is actually quite large relative to the global average, in half, they could reduce their greenhouse gas footprint by half. So they didn't need to go vegetarian or vegan, but just making a dent in what they're eating. Likewise, they could make even less aggressive shifts, like maybe shifting from beef to pork or poultry. And even shifts like that could reduce their greenhouse gas impacts by 15%.
What?
Or, you know, maybe cutting out some of that beef and eating beans. Or, you know, instead of taking two slices of ham, take one slice of ham. So it was more about less and increasing the share of plant-based protein than it was about preaching abstinence around vegan and vegetarian, which I think for the mainstream is not going to catch on that quickly. So,
right.
So what we thought is that you don't have to become vegetarian and vegan to make a big difference to your environmental footprint of your diet.
And what role does the government subsidy play in keeping the price of beef so, so low, particularly in this country? And is that something that could change?
So the government subsidies are largely thinking about how to support, you know, the farms on the production side. I think there's a need to do a much better job of creating a connection to the health side. So, you know, just thinking about them as agricultural subsidies means you immediately thought about only the production side of diets, you know, the food production. And one of the sort of recommendations we make is that there needs to be more coherence across, you know, government agencies. So one is the issue around health and then the issue around production subsidies. And the production subsidies should start to think about, you know, what kind of food we need, you know, to support a healthy diet. So if we're subsidizing foods that are very high in calories or animal-based products, you know, does that support our health objectives or even our environmental objectives as a nation? We need to connect the dots better on there. So the subsidies are very large for some of the high-impact foods on both health and the planet, I think it's fair to say.
And you make the, you know, you are very clear to say that this isn't going after farmers in any way, that if anything, it should, in the long run, help redistribute some of that money around small farmers, right?
Yeah, that's a good point because you know we really were pained to say that we're not expecting large areas of pasture land to go wasted now because you know we've cut out animals and animal-based foods. Nor are we trying to put the small you know livestock farmer out of business. What we're saying is there's actually an expected doubling of beef consumption between now and 2050. And most of the land that's suitable for pasture or even growing crops to feed cattle are already in production. So if we don't take a, if we don't start to reduce in high consuming countries like the US as other countries increase their footprint, it's going to drive massive deforestation and land change. So, you know, yes, there's going to be a lot of meat consumed over the next 50 years, but what we're trying to do is to just reduce consumption, recognizing that it's rising very rapidly.
What role does the fast food industry play in this? Is the consumption of meat primarily in processed form, or is it home cooks going to the grocery store and buying too many steaks, or is it a combination?
It's probably a combination. We didn't look specifically at the issue of processed food, although it certainly, as we started to look at some of the health impacts of different dietary changes, the issue of processed food and processed meat specifically did sort of percolate to the top as certainly a factor.
We need to take a quick break. I'm so riveted and fascinated by this subject. As I was reading it, I was like, I just want to go and like hang out in their office. This fascinates me to no end. Janet, if you could stay on the line, we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some of the things that individual people can do in their own diets to affect some kind of change.
It's not just your garden. It's the way you live. And there's so much to know. But you have help. Bonnie Plants. Now with Bonnie's app, Homegrown, you can learn about veggie and herb varieties, track and record your garden with photos and notes, share on Facebook and Twitter, and so much more. How'd you ever grow without it? Get Homegrown with Bonnie Plants for iPhone and Android. The more you know, the better you can grow with Bonnie.
The one and only Dave Arnold brings the noise to Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday on Cooking Issues.
Coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn!
If the bomb was going to drop, and you only had 15 minutes, which is like, I can make a sandwich in 15 minutes. He would be eating a sandwich.
I'd kiss my wife, make a sandwich.
If you believe that it's all about to be over, why eat healthy? I'm not a freaking Neanderthal. I like a tempered ice cream sandwich. But it's the only way to get around it if you're a party master, because you're going to wind up, like, your kitchen's going to fill with dishes. And
some people have commercial dishwashers in their house.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
I've seen them.
Who?
Really rich people.
For more mile-a-minute knowledge from Dave and the crew, listen to Cooking Issues, available on Heritage Radio Network, iTunes, and Stitcher.
Welcome back to Sharp and Hot. Joining me from Washington, D.C. via phone is Janet Ranganathan, VP for Science and Research at the World Resources Institute, and we are talking about the new publication, Shifting Diets for a Sustainable Future. Janet, I can be of the opinion that the individual's choice doesn't matter all that much when we're talking about something at a global scale. But you said something before the break, which was if we reduce our beef consumption, we can reduce our individual carbon footprint by half. So I am wrong if that's true.
No, that's right. So we actually we looked at the land use and greenhouse gas impacts of the average U.S. diet. Just bear in mind that the average U.S. diet for the average male, they're consuming about twice as much protein as they actually need to meet the dietary recommendations. But anyway, modeling the average U.S. person, we actually found that 95% of the greenhouse gas impact, 95% of the land use impact of that diet came from animal-based food products, so meat and dairy, and about 85% of the greenhouse gas emissions. And what was even more startling for me was that around 50% of the land use and greenhouse gas impact came from beef alone, even though beef is, it's just one of the many ingredients of animal-based food products that we consume. So,
and that's because cows...
Yeah, beef can have a big impact.
And that's because cows are so demanding of space and resources, right?
Yeah, it goes back to that 1% efficiency for calories, or, 1% efficiency conversion for calories, or it's around about 4% for protein.
So right now, it is a very popular belief from weight loss and fitness circles. I use an app called MyFitnessPal, and it's, all of the writing, the pop exercise writing maybe, is about this high-protein diet. Like, everyone should be eating a high-protein diet. And I went back, anticipating this conversation, I went back through my fitness pal, and because I'm fairly diligent about logging everything I eat, because I like to gamify my life and I find it to be entertaining, I have an average of about 100 grams, sometimes more, of protein every day. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm one of those people.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. I mean, I actually was at a launch of the International Food Policy Research Institute report the other day. And as I walked back along K Street, I was sort of noticing all these protein bars and protein shakes. So I think there seems to be this sort of concern that people aren't getting enough protein. I mean, foods are now advertised as very high in protein. But the fact of the matter is, that the average U.S. person's getting 66% more protein than they actually need. And for a man, that's almost double. And then the other interesting thing is that actually people don't realize that they're getting a lot of protein from their plant-based food sources. So if you take sort of 50 grams on average as what the average person wants, about half of that they're already getting from their plant-based food. So to get from about 30 to 50 grams, you only need about, a medium serving of a chicken breast, a 4-ounce chicken breast will get you over what you need.
And I think one of the
thinking about meat to every meal.
Right, and I think also people. Okay, wait. So say that again. A 4-ounce serving of chicken breast is enough protein for one day.
Well, combined with the average amount of plant-based protein people are getting in the U.S., just 4 ounces of chicken will get them up to where they need to be.
And that's, I think, one of the things that people need to hear over and over again in terms of portion size. That is a deck of playing cards. Right? It's a very small amount when you look at it on a plate. So how are some ways that people can change their expectations about having meat at every meal and meat being a sign of sort of, you know, things are going well?
Yeah. So the cultural shift is difficult. We've been thinking about that. You know, how do we actually shift the masses? And so We did take a look at, you know, the strategies that are being deployed now, and I would say that I would characterize most of them as sort of focused on, you know, providing consumers with information, education, campaigns around abstinence like Meatless Monday. But our sense is that they're not. We need to go beyond those. They're good and they're important, but we need strategies that really sort of work in step with how people purchase and consume food. So we've been looking at how, you know, really taking a leaf out of the private sector. How does private sector sort of drive large-scale shifts? And they do. They do this quite effectively. What sort of strategies do they use? And could we adopt some of those strategies here for this approach? So that's something we're looking at as some next steps to this study.
Can you give me some ideas of what that would look like for a home cook?
Oh, well, for home cook, we're thinking that, you know, so we found out that about, you know, last year, for the first time, the average American spent more consuming food outside the home than in the inside. So we sort of see the food service sector, the restaurants and cafeterias, as a particularly important player in helping to shift people's diet. So, you know, if we could get, you know, the big burger outlets to think about, well, maybe they can serve up a beef burger that's sort of 30% mushroom layer and 70% beef, you know, as an alternative, and maybe marketing it as sort of a healthy, low cholesterol option. That might be very effective, and that the habits that people, you know, pick up in terms of food consumption in restaurants may be carried back home to what they might do in the kitchen.
I wonder if there's a way to do it like Kraft Macaroni and Cheese did when they shifted their recipe and didn't tell anyone. And then after they sold something like 2 million boxes or 2 billion, some crazy number were sold, then they like very quietly were like, by the way, there's no more artificial color and artificial flavor in there, and you didn't notice a difference. And it was this big like media coup because everybody was like, wait, what? Oh, okay. And I wonder if the average person who is consuming fast food or eating beef out of the house, which is a lot of people, myself included, if telling them that there was a healthy option, if they would do it, you know, would you choose that? And I don't know. I mean, I want to believe that the answer is yes, but I'm not certain that that is, I don't know.
Well, the stealth strategy has been quite effective. They've been using that strategy in a number of countries now, in the UK, to reduce the amount of salt in food, just gradually reducing it every year. I mean, the government's required this from the food industry, and people hadn't noticed. Like, so I'm British, as you can maybe tell from the accent. When I go back to the UK and I haven't eaten there for a while, I can tell the difference, but you wouldn't notice it.
Right.
We identified an interesting example from Birdseye. So, you know, Birdseye, you know, had to make the shift from cod, which was, you know, being, you know, at risk of being overfished, to pollock. And now in fish sticks, you know, called fish fingers in the UK, people really want to have a cod fish finger. They don't want a pollock fish finger. So, but Birdseye actually made a successful shift introducing pollock, but not actually splashing that all over the box. But they found that pollock had more omega-3. So they just marketed it as, you know, omega, you know, fish stick high in omega-3, and that was very effective in, you know, selling a compelling benefit to the consumer to make the shift.
Right. And I guess one of the pieces of advice that I have been, you know, sort of trying to live by myself is if I'm going to consume beef, well, like I refer to it as sort of all four-legged animals, beef and pork primarily. I try to buy it directly from the farmer. So I live in New Jersey. We have lots of farmers markets, and I have access to beef that I can buy directly from the person who raised those cows. Is that that's still a better option, right, than sort of mindlessly buying?
We've actually got to stay, you know, focused on, you know, sustainable production mechanisms. That's all very necessary because meat consumption is going to continue. What our report does says don't just think about, you know, the production side. Also think about your choices of food because they can be as important as how the food's actually produced.
Janet Ranganathan from the World Resources Institute, thank you so, so much for coming on Sharp and Hot. I have tweeted out the link to the PDF. I highly recommend everyone reading it. Janet, we are going to end our conversation here. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
I truly appreciate it. Listeners, I cannot recommend it enough. There are incredibly fascinating infographics to take a look at impact and choice and all of that different stuff. And it's really invested in research. And it's not going to make your eyes glaze over. It's really, really going to inform your food choices, which I think it sounds like you don't. No one's asking anybody to give up eating whole groups of things entirely. It's just being more mindful about where you get those things that you're putting into your body. To that end, today is day 50 for me without any drinking. It has been the best decision I have made. Everyone keeps telling me how great I look. So for vanity alone, like, yeah, I'm going to keep doing this. And I have to say, the weekends, like Friday nights have been kind of rough because I'm like, oh man, I just really want, like, I want fill in the blank here. And I have found that talking about that urge to my husband has been very helpful instead of just trying to like white knuckle through this craving. And then this weekend was the first weekend that I was like, yeah, no, cool. I'm cool. And it's great. So I'll just check in with you guys and let you know that I am still on that train. And for those of you who emailed me, your messages of support and your sharing your stories and your own relationships with substances that sometimes are a little slippery in terms of control, thank you. It has been very, very sweet to hear about everybody else out there and made me feel very much not alone. If you want to get in touch with me, you can email me, chefemily@sharpandhot.com. You can tweet me at chefemilyp. You can find us at heritageradionetwork.org. I am on Instagram at chefemilyp. I have sort of fallen off my hashtag sharpandhot thing, but you guys, I keep getting books, so I got to get back on mailing people stuff because I have so many cookbooks that I just don't have enough time to get through all of them. So use the hashtag #SharpAndHot. I'll get in touch and I will mail you a book with some Heritage Radio Network stickers, and that will be yours to sit on your bookshelf, and I will put in a book plate with it. Otherwise, let's see. I'm going to pull up. Let's see. Dave, I should have done this earlier. I'm going to try to make a new habit of telling people who is going to be on next week.
Spring resolution.
That's my spring resolution. It's like, oh, and tune in next week because I've been doing a pretty good job of booking people out in advance instead of not, instead of the opposite, which is not knowing who's going to be on next week. So I am always trying to make the show better. So, oh, yes. Oh, Judy Ju, author of Korean Made Simple, who's got her own show on the Cooking Channel, is going to be in studio with me talking about Korean cooking at home. And I'm super, super excited to talk to her because Korean food, if I had to pick one thing forever, it would be a very tight contest between Korea and Mexico. So I'm super excited to have her on. She will be in studio with me next week. Until then, you can find me on Twitter at Chef Emily P. I look forward to talking to all of you and keep playing with fire and knives.
Sharp and hot with Chef Emily. Sharp and hot with Chef.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.